Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program from the Antioch Writers' Workshop, Rebecca Morian reads from her latest novel, Above the Curtain of Heaven. Antioch University Chancellor Dr. Tony Murdoch announced she'll retire in June of 2012. This week, she spoke with Emily McCord about her decision and the university's future. Up first, the making of a comic book. Charlie Bath enlisted in the Army in 1941, a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. For 4 years, he proudly served as a wire chief in the Signal Corps. That job involved running telephone wire all over France and Germany. Charlie was the guy who could climb, so that's what he did. Climbed poles, often checking for live wires by hitting them with a wrench. Now, at 90 years old, Charlie's days aren't so dangerous, usually meeting fellow World War II veterans Earl Ellis and Jack Newhouse, also in their 90s at McDonald's in Xenia.
Earl's wife had died, and my wife had died in 04. So we just started meeting down there, and we met down there. We stayed there for 2 or 3 hours every morning, except Sunday, and then we go to Lee's.
The group calls themselves the Liars Club because of their creative scorekeeping in golf over the last 23 years and their ability to mix some tall tales in with the truth. Sharing stories at McDonald's is what got them noticed by author-illustrator Michael Fleischman and his wife Joanne. Michael teaches commercial art at Edison Community College in Piqua. He asked if he could interview the guys about their lives.
I'm not really sure they quite understood what I was really getting at, but God love them, they agreed to do it. And the idea came, okay, let's create the book involving, you know, so photography and then actual illustration to tie it all together. The idea was always to do a real comic book out of it, word balloons and text panels and all that.
And so what are your hopes for this project?
Well, we had a big event in Xenia, another Veterans Day event. And to see it, how it really touched people, the veterans and their families, was wonderful. It was just great. A lot of the World War II vets are not going to be with us for very long, unfortunately. And they have incredible stories to tell. And I always thought that the comic book was a very accessible way to get those stories out there. It would be a shame if the stories aren't heard. Yeah. There's just amazing things about life and love. And society, their stories are really the little snapshots of society and history, our culture at that point in time.
And Charlie, what do you think about the attention that you're getting, all the interviews? And
well, I'm not much for it. I'll do it a little bit, but not a whole lot. It's all right. Yeah. But I never bragged about the service or any of that. I just told small, minor details. That's about it. Yeah. I could, but I don't.
So you're a Xenia resident. How long have you been there?
Almost 91 years. I was born in Xenia. And in 1921, I was born in Xenia. And still there. I'll be 91 January 6th, next year, 2012.
Yeah. If I can, one of the things about a comic book is that, you know, an everyday guy turns out to he's a superhero and he saves the world. And I thought that a comic book about these everyday heroes was a super idea. And it's been a pleasure and a privilege to know you all.
Gentlemen, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
With some funding from the Greene County Council on Aging and illustrations from Edison student Mark Gibbs, Michael finished the comic book in time for Veterans Day. It's on exhibit with more of Fleischman's work at the Yellow Springs Arts Council Gallery through November 26th. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Antioch University Chancellor Dr. Tony Murdoch announced she will retire in June of 2012. This week, she spoke with Emily McCord about her decision and the university's future.
It's also been, especially in the last couple of years, it's been a tough economy, and it's been an interesting environment for higher education. What have you learned in the last couple of years about the state of higher education?
One of the interesting things that I think that we're looking at is through time, the whole issue of who benefits from higher education, is it the individual or is it society? That pendulum has swung so much over to the general population feeling that it is the individual and then consequently the individual should pay for that, has also had an impact upon our Congress to where they have tried to move away from grants, outright grants for education, higher education, to the loan area and to shift people over into the loan. Now, we know through time now that the loan amount that students have now is over $1 trillion if we look at nationally. And my biggest concern now is that they're talking about taking away the subsidy and the interest subsidy. Now, I myself would never have gotten my bachelor's, master's without a loan, a federal loan, in which they paid for my interest while I was in school. And I didn't have to start paying for that until I was able to graduate. And the way that's being configured now is no low interest and immediate payback. I think this is going to have a tremendous detrimental effect, because if you look at the demographics, we are looking at an increase in the number of students that are what we would say 24 to 30 years of age who need a bachelor's completion degree, who don't have the money to be able to invest in what higher education is charging nowadays. I'm greatly concerned about that. And I always go back to my historical roots of looking at how our founding fathers appreciated and knew the importance of higher education. Without an educated populace, your ability to have truly a democratic system is very much at risk. And somewhere we've lost that in our understanding of what the role of education plays in our society.
Now, how would you describe the current state of Antioch University?
Well, we're the healthiest we've ever been, I think, in history. We have been able to build our reserves. Our enrollments have been very strong. Through this first recession, we did very well in keeping and maintaining and even increasing our enrollments at some place. This second wave that we're going through right now, we are seeing a leveling of our enrollment, a little bit of downturn in others. Ohio is probably of the states that we have, was hit the hardest of the campuses that we have. So we really are looking now at kind of restructuring, re-strategizing how we build new programs. And one of the areas that we feel is extremely important for this new student is our flexibility, and much of that will be done virtually. So we are gearing up, putting up much more money into the information technology. We're looking at what we would call hybrid courses so that students have the opportunity to take online courses within a program, but also have residential. And we're even looking to see about some degree completion programs that may be totally online. Because we realize the population that we deal with are individuals who work, they have family, they have parents often to take care of. They need 24/7 type of services to be able to access their education and complete their education. So you'll see us moving a lot in that in that direction to try to figure out how do we make our education more accessible, affordable, and more flexible.
You've been at the helm of Antioch University during just a lot of change in the university's life. Talk to me a little bit about where things are now. The university and the college are now separate institutions. Can you tell me a little bit about that process?
Well, I've been actually with the university 14 years. So I have seen a tremendous amount of transition. And when I look at coming into the chancellorship at the time that I did and recognizing the financial peril that we were all in, it wasn't just college, we were all in jeopardy in relation to the financial situation. I think what is most important to me and stands out most in that whole process was that we were able to recognize the desires of the alums to be able to have the opportunity to bring the college back. We were able to find a means by which we would not jeopardize the financial health of the university while at the same time being able to transfer the assets of the college so that they would have some foundation from which to start to begin their process. So for me, what you're seeing now are two institutions with the commitment and support of the college from their alumni and the work they're doing in fundraising, and a university that is has a demand from adult students for graduate education that's spread throughout the nation, that now also financially has a sound underpinning, ability to invest in where we're going. So I think it's a win-win for both of us.
There are other changes happening at the university, and one regarded the establishment of a board of governors and having different board chairs at every campus. Tell me, what was the impetus behind those moves?
Right. Well, each of these campuses are located in communities that some are urban, some are rural. But my emphasis and one of my big pushes to support these local boards or the establishment of them is that we really, as part of our Antioch values, are very much engaged in community service. We want these campuses at the various locations to be seen as part of their community. We want them engaged in the community. We want the communities to feel like it's their institution and not some entity out of Ohio that is in there taking tuition money and shuffling it off to Ohio or something, but that it truly is engaged in the community and investing in that particular community. And we wanted board members, we wanted people to be supportive of that institution. So it truly is about our community engagement and our desire to give back to the community and to be seen as a common good for the places that we reside. And a national board really did not in the past and could not be able to generate that kind of interest at the local level.
WYSO Public Radio is licensed to Antioch University, also going through a transition. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what's next for WYSO.
Yeah, well, we're pretty excited that you're going to get the new facilities. This is something that we've known and struggled with, I guess, to say what are we going to do? So because there was kind of a domino effect about and investing in WISO's facilities and how do we deal with the administration and where does administration need to go.
And WYSO will be moving to the Kettering Building on Livermore in Yellow Springs, on Livermore Street in Yellow Springs, sometime in the spring of 2012.
We're very excited about WISO's new home. Took a tour yesterday or day before yesterday of the construction that's going on. So can't wait for you to move into your new facilities. So excited about the work that you're doing. I think Nina Ellis is just walks on water. The other thing is that we're really starting to look at some partnerships with WISO in relation to offering some programs, a media program, a course that she's working with our Seattle campus and also our Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. And I would see that that's probably going to increase in relation to really engaging WISO in helping us more in an educational framework and for our students and for our programs.
What's next for you personally?
Well, I'd like to say my first vacation in real vacation in 6 years. The next 8 months is going to be, you know, I'm still employed and we've got a lot of work to do because there are some projects I want to make sure that are in place before I leave because they've been a love of my life. And then after that, I've spent 40 years in higher education, and there's so much of that world out there that I haven't had a chance to experience. And so I'd like to take a little time to reflect on that and kind of explore other pathways in the world and other interests that I have.
I've been speaking with the Chancellor of Antioch University, Tony Murdoch. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much, Emily. It's wonderful to be back in studio again.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning. Continuing our series of faculty readings from this summer's Antioch Writers Workshop, Rebecca Morian is a novelist, short story writer, essayist, and an assistant professor of English at Sinclair Community College. Here she reads from a recently completed novel.
This is taken from a novel that I finished about a month ago. It's with my agent right now, and it's called Above the Curtain of Heaven, or Being God and Other Unfortunate Avocations. And it's about a novelist named Magdalene Profeti who is writing a book about four agnostics who decide to create a religion. And it goes viral on the internet. There's MP3 files involved. There's things called proclamations. Tent cities pop up across the United States, all over the world. And suddenly, a writer, a poet, and a music designer are suddenly hold the world's fate in their hands. They have to decide whether there's a heaven and a hell. And it affects all religions. It's also a commentary on social media. The first section is the very beginning of the novel when we're introduced to Magdalene Profeti. There's a list of 10 tweets, God's tweets. There's 10 of them at the beginning of the book, and then it opens. She didn't know how it would turn out, any of it. The screen of the white laptop cast a sterile fluorescent echo across the tiny dining room table. Magdalene Profeti sat very still, waiting for the next sign, the next nearly imperceptible flicker, a misty hum, a silky thread she could pull from the background noise. The cigarette sat curling smoke, and Forty thumped his thick blonde tail. A cup of tepid coffee sat in a Moody's diner mug next to the plain red one from yesterday's venture. Fight or flight responses thrummed now that all was set in motion and she didn't want to control it. In her world of order, she craved chaos, even if self-inflicted. Finally, she moved, slowly, her hips stiff from an early morning walk. Forty stretched and yawned, padded after her to the window, licked her bare knee with his wide, hot tongue. She should have brought the cigarette with her. She sipped the lukewarm coffee, letting her mind tally up the morning. Egg, 90 calories, cream and coffee, 30, half a grapefruit, 30. What she really wanted was something sweet, and in a past life she would have found herself at the kitchen sink, wolfing a bowl of thick, cold coffee ice cream. Maybe it was time to leave, go do something else. No, that was the flight response, the one she must soldier through. Ideas linked one to another like a chain and then stopped. She was only at a chink. Maybe it was best to just return to them, to those people, an odd mix of friends, acquaintances, strangers, who all felt like two-dimensional characters peopling her world right now. Sighing, she sat back down at the kitchen table. Meg took a long pull on her cigarette, blew the smoke out between her lips, and hit the button and reread the list of tweets that would intermittently inoculate her novel. She could pull one out when she needed it. Not that she knew the mechanics yet, but Dominique would help her set up the account and choose an avatar. Saved. There. Another housekeeping job finished. She fingered the end of her cigarette, rolling it around in a comfortable, papery, familiar kind of way. Meg hadn't smoked in years, not since her last flood-out run for a novel, and she knew it would kill her if she ever really started. But she only smoked when she wrote, and always outdoors or by an open window, so the apartment never smelled. The only time she liked cigarette smoke was on the intake. The first pull, After that, it was all habit, a kind of husky, ethereal grease, necessary like Dumbo's feather for the confidence to sucker words. She rubbed out the half-smoked stub in an old orange and yellow plaid beanbag cigarette holder she'd found in the attic, and thank God she wrote fast. If she was one of those anal retentive authors who agonized over every single word in the first draft, she'd be hooked on tobacco and dead by 45. But she was fast and furious. Balzac, James called her, when she was up until 3 a.m. pounding away on the electric Corona in the bathroom. James, who was big-boned and doughy and needed, Meg thought later, to sharpen both pencils and his wit, was one of her past loves, her first real love, not a love anymore. She referred to him as a PPIMPL, a pimple, a past person of importance in my personal life. This became a joke between she and Beryl after James left her for a tall, stringy poet named Jessica Harlow, who aggressively boasted about having an affair with a Polish philosopher and moved like a loose, sophisticated cat. Meg always felt like a solid, colorless toad whenever Jessica curled around her and purred.
Author and educator Rebecca Moyen at the Antioch Writers' Workshop. Spoken word artist Jay Martinez has been performing in Dayton for 10 years and has a book of poetry called An Orator's Declamation of the Ghetto. Martinez recently launched a national tour, and Community Voices producer Caressa Brown spoke with him about how hip-hop influenced his unique poetry and style.
I used to be all into the hip-hop, freestyling with my dudes in high school in the hallway. We'd have a cypher, like a group of us in a circle, one doing the beatbox. I used to rap a lot and freestyle, whatever, and I came to Wilberforce University, and I went to open mic for the first time, and I seen it, and I just fell in love, and it opened my eyes to a whole nother world of, you know, lyrical delivery, and since then, I ran with it. The piece I'm about to do is basically a little political. It talks about, it takes a stance on, you know, our situation and how it stems from the past, and then what's going on with a young man now who is basically addicted to drugs. A lot of my upbringing was seeing a lot of people either selling or being addicted to drugs, and, you know, a lot of my people's pieces kind of entail that. And so I try to either enlighten or bring a breath of fresh air to those who know the experience. Here you go. Now, it's been said that a criminal mind is subjected to a minimal time to read through biblical rhymes. But if you give this man one chance to drink from the spiritual wine, you'll see that he'll repent and break free of all his critical vines. But the media feeds us this nonsense while we live in these despicable times. Only way that I can give you a visual sign is if I keep spitting and hitting you with these lyrical rhymes. Little do they know a lot of us have unpredictable minds. We gon' get it with the knowledge, which is why more than a third of us have admitted to the college. But the fight for our freedom is what I'm discussing. Tell me, was the trust in informing the equal, but I find this quote quite disgusting. Disgusting, especially since the ones who created the Bill of Rights are the ones used to kill at night. They would kill at sight, they would only kill our type. They give me affirmative action, but still I fight. I'ma shine regardless if they steal my light, and they can lock me up, put me through any of their programs, send me off to this earth like a blind man with no hands, like a misguided child with no plans. Yet and still, I fear no man, regardless of his position or role. A man can take my life, but only God can take my soul. For this I pray to one majesty, I don't listen to blasphemy for me, cause I love when the devil's mad at me. But it's sad to see this world come to such a tragedy. I just do what he ask of me. See, I don't see this world the same ever since I got my sight from above. And then they trying to take away the life that I love. They better use a knife or a slug. You take away my pen, I'll cut my finger and write with my blood. You wanna feel my pain? Just give me a mic with a plug. Every time I spit this to my people, it feel like I'm getting right from a drug. And right now, I'm feeling nice from a buzz. I just hope that every word spitting and have your nerve twitching. I'm just thankful you were able to see it with your third vision. But if I go to war, then I'ma have to fight alone, just me, myself, and the microphone. For too many years I've seen dark, even when the lights was on, cause my sight was gone despite what's wrong. But life goes on, but how do you know when wrong is right, or maybe right was wrong? My mind's been trapped for too long, and I finally seen the light of dawn. But the future's still forsaken. Going from a baby to an adult is just a rude awakening. But check this out, this young cat, he starts smoking trees, then he gets to lacing them. Now everybody knows why his waist and face is slim. His own family no longer embraces him. He can't even feed his belly lest the cops just start chasing him. He sees a drug dealer, he owe money, so he gotta start the race again. He keeps a razor in his pocket just in case it's him. He's shooting up his neck cause his arms are running out of space again. He looks up in the mirror, he can't even face his grin, cause he knows his whole body and soul was replaced this his sin. And all he could think about is his next hit and a taste of gin. He done messed up his life, so who gon' choose to take him in? We walk past him every day, never even think of facing him. But if you look into his eyes, he's a child of God and there's no replacing him. But how can I expect this world to provide for me when all of this is lied to me? Too many of our soldiers die and bleed. When a dying needs with the last of a dying breed, don't even ask me why we die for greed. From the nonsense we go through, it's no wonder so many get high off trees. But the outsiders looking in, they will never understand why we'll smoke trees to the brain to put an ease to the pain, while the rest of my peoples bleed from the veins. On top of this, we need money to proceed in this game, so the rest of us die for the greed of the fame. Whether it's hustling or having to squeeze with the flame, but how can I believe what is vain, what I'm trying to achieve in the brain? But at the same time, it's hard to see through the rain. These are some of the things I can't seem to explain. When my mom's had me, she conceived with a strain. So everything I just spoke on, it's only the tip of the iceberg. Give it to you in the form of precise words. So welcome to my world.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and I'm joined today by Ellen Belcher. She's the former editor of the Dayton Daily News editorial page. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So the nation's eyes were on Ohio this week as voters overwhelmingly overturned Issue 2. That's the referendum on the law that limits collective bargaining rights. What can we take away from this week as we look towards the 2012 election?
Well, I think the Democrats and Labor did a great job of energizing their base. The Columbus Dispatch reported this week that more people voted against Issue 2 than voted for John Kasich a year ago. And that's a really, in an off-election year, that's a significant figure. I mean, they brought out the people. Of course, the question is, can they maintain that momentum going into 2012? The Republicans think not. They think this was an aberration and that a year is a long time and that voters will vote their pocketbooks in 2012, and I think Kevin DeWine said Barack Obama, not Senate Bill 5, will be on the ballot next year. So there's work to be done on both sides.
And of course, there was also Issue 3. Voters approved the constitutional amendment that would have Ohioans be opted out of the federal health care mandate. So it's kind of sending a mixed message there.
Well, the Issue 3 in real terms meant nothing. It was simply a statement that Ohioans don't like the idea of being mandated to join a health care plan. The federal health care reform law would trump anything even that is now going to be in Ohio's constitution. But absolutely, the fact that that issue passed so overwhelmingly certainly has to be giving the Obama people pause and heartening the Republicans. Now, the other side of that coin, though, is unlike with Issue 2, where there was lots of information out there, lots of people campaigning and talking about the issue, there was hardly any discussion of Issue 3, and I think a lot of people went to the polls not knowing exactly what they were voting on, and there was very little tug of war over how the language was going to be worded. Ohioans, you know, like a lot of people, there's some pushback about government telling them too much about how to do something as personal as health care. But at the same time, I don't think that the results of Issue 3 are necessarily a referendum on whether or not everybody should be mandated to join into a health care plan, because there was just no discussion of it and what it meant.
So going back to Issue 2 for a moment, Republicans in Ohio are not saying a lot right now as to how they're going to move forward with the aftermath of Issue 2's defeat. What do you think we can expect from them?
Well, of course, they're stinging and they're licking their wounds, and this is a huge setback for the governor. This was his signature project after Jobs Ohio, and he was the face of the campaign. He was out there saying, we have to have this, we absolutely need this. I think, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who are scared to go forward. I think a lot of people would agree that there are things in Ohio's collective bargaining law that are unbalanced, that need to be fixed. The polls showed that during the campaign, that there were planks in Senate Bill 5 that people in Ohio supported changing. And the message they sent, I think, to the governor is, hey, 302 pages of changes and no real give and take with the Democrats is not the way that we want to fix the problem. Because when you look at the how the votes went on Tuesday, 82 of 80 counties rejected this. 10 counties rejected it by 70% or more. So, you know, the governor said on election night in his press conference that he was going to take a pause. I think what that means is anything he does is going to be tentative, and he's going to at least have to try and work with Democrats on some of the changes that he wants.
Now, Tea Party groups, though, are pushing for a constitutional amendment that would prevent workers from being required to join unions. Is this going to gain traction?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think what, I mean, this has to be driving the Kasich administration crazy in the wake of the overwhelming defeat on Tuesday, because the Tea Party organizers are out there saying, hey, we want to make Ohio a right-to-work state. 22 other states in the country are right-to-work. And given the thumping that happened on Senate Bill 5, that's not the conversation the Kasich administration wants to have right now going into a presidential election year next year. Now, it's very possible that the Tea Party won't be able to get enough signatures to get it on the ballot in 2012, and it would have to wait for till 2013. But just having the conversation makes it difficult for Republicans in this environment after what happened on Senate Bill 5.
I've been speaking with Ellen Belcher. She's the former editor of the Dayton Daily News editorial page. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Emily. It was great fun.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. Thanks to all of our guests. Coming up next on Member Support at 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.